Welcome to Fronteras, a program that explores issues at the border and beyond through the lens of arts, culture, and history. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. Most people remember reading that one book that changed or affirmed how they viewed themselves, the book that changed your life, the book that revealed hidden truths, the book that made you stand up for others. These revelations often come in higher education, perhaps in an ethnic studies class or in another literature course. Prisca Dorcas Mojica Rodriguez writes to reach those who might not have access to academia. Mojica Rodriguez is the author of For Brown Girls with Sharp Edges and Tender Hearts and of Tias and Primas on Knowing and Loving the Women Who Raised Us. Mojica Rodriguez writes about the cultural challenges faced by brown girls, like imposter syndrome, sexism, and the pressure to be the good girl. She says she wants to write the words she wanted to read when she was younger, the words that will guide brown girls to acceptance, sisterhood, and even rebellion.
I was an avid reader. Like, I read a lot as a kid. So you'd think I would have stumbled onto something with some commentary, some social commentary or something, but I didn't. While I was getting my undergraduate that I started to read about systemic oppression, like social ills, like racism, sexism, colorism. It was in my master's program, and it was so excruciating to be first gen. It is like, if you're a first gen college student, you know, like, it's hard, and there's a lot of closed doors that you see, and you have to sneak in almost, and you have to push your way in. So by the time I was getting my master's and I started getting this material, I felt like it was transformative. Like, it changed the way I viewed everything, like questions and weird feelings that I'd always had about things. It gave me names to things. And I just remember being angry the whole time because I was like, why didn't anybody talk to me about this sooner? Why wasn't this something that anybody brought up, or even just I stumbled into? I was the kind of reader, I would go to Goodwill and just pick a section of books. The books were like 50 cents if they were paperback, and I think it was like $1 or 75 cents if they were hardcover. I wouldn't look at covers. I wouldn't look at titles. I just wanted to read. And so I would pick a row and just push them into my cart. So I would have loved to have stumbled onto that as somebody who, I didn't pick a genre to read in. I just wanted to read and learn all the time. So yeah, I just got increasingly frustrated that this wasn't anything that I had access to until I was in my mid-20s. And I'd already made big decisions about my life that felt like if I had gotten better information, I would have chosen differently. Like, I was married. I got married really young. I just wanted that stuff sooner. And I know why it's not made sooner. I mean, academic books require an academic degree to read them. They're really hard. Even me, that I have a master's, I have to read some of the books out loud because it's so hard to understand what they're saying sometimes. And academics aren't, they're researchers, but a lot of them, the assumption is that they're supposed to write, but a lot of them aren't writers. And so, like, they're also just not writing the things in a way that's engaging, even though it's good stuff. I don't know if you've ever heard of Clarissa Pinkola Estes, Women Who Run with Wolves. It's an academic book that took me 10 years to read because it was never assigned. And I was frustrated that it was so hard to read. Or like Simone de Beauvoir wrote The Second Sex, which is like a feminist philosopher, like foundational book you need to read. It's 800 pages and the print is really small, but it, like, as you read it, you just feel like your brain is getting bigger. Like, you just like, oh, you have so many aha moments in a book like that. You just don't read at any other point unless you have a very specific degree at a master's or PhD level. And yeah, I was like, I want to write a book that makes people have those aha moments, but they don't have to have a college degree potentially to read it. Like, they could just pick it up with their tías and just talk about it during dinner and be like, did you read that? What did you think about that? That just makes people think differently about what they have been told.
Well, that kind of pulls me into another similar angle to what you're talking about. I mean, your aha moment also comes when other Latinos or Latinas are in college and they see that there's a, you know, for example, a Mexican American studies course, and they take it, oh, I need an elective, let's get some hours. And that becomes their aha moment where they start really learning about their past and about their heritage, stuff that they may have heard hints about from their abuelas, from their tios, from their tias. And now it seems, here in Texas particularly, you're seeing those aha moments start to be diluted because there is a crackdown on being taught sort of this alternate but true history. Can you comment about that? I mean, because these aha moments, I don't think are going to be coming as frequently as they should anymore to communities of color that really need to hear them.
Yeah, I agree. And I think it's a disservice too, because it is, the college students are at least getting a little bit of taste of that. And it does take that from us. And it's kind of why I feel passionate about it. Shouldn't require us to go to college. Statistically, we know Latinas are underrepresented as college students, as master's students, and the statistic gets smaller and smaller with PhD students. To be Latina and have those degrees, we're already at a deficit. So like the few of us that get to college, right, and then take that one Chicano studies class and have that aha moment is already like one in a million. It's already really diluted as is. And yeah, they just took that opportunity from us to have those aha moments with somebody who's skilled enough to walk us through the aha moments too, right? Because like that is a lot of information to take in. And you have a lot of questions when you take that in. And it is beneficial to have a professor who is an expert in that field walk you through like, yeah, this did happen. And then this other book that you should read that is not required on your, but you should read it. Well, that's when I was like, well, I want to read it. I mean, it made school exciting. It made it so that I have the career that I have today. And I didn't think that was even an option going to school. It was like tangible jobs. Like you become a teacher, a nurse, or a doctor, or like a lawyer, but like that's kind of it. But my degree has led to me writing and being an author. And I love college students. I love first gen students. I write about them all the time. But I am interested in the people who don't have access to that college student having the aha moment, who's coming home and sharing that. A lot of the people in our countries get degrees and then come here and those degrees don't translate. My dad was a teacher. And so he doesn't do that here in the U.S. And my mom didn't graduate college. So I was always trying to think of like, how do I make my parents understand what I just learned without it feeling disrespectful? Because that's also a thing. It's like, why are you talking to me like I don't know anything? Because now you have a college degree. So yeah, it is such a disservice. All the DEI stuff is such a disservice to our communities. But I do hope to be bridging some of that gap in my work. It feels like a very daunting and scary and sad reality, though.
Prisca Dorcas Mojica Rodriguez is the author of For Brown Girls with Sharp Edges and Tender Hearts and of Tias and Primas on Knowing and Loving the Women Who Raised Us. When we come back, Mojica Rodriguez unearthed a lot of feelings that had been buried in guilt while she was writing her books.
I'm the oldest daughter in an immigrant household, and I feel this sense of responsibility for my family. And so I didn't allow myself to be angry at my parents.
Our conversation continues next on Fronteras.
Your workplace giving program makes it easy to support the causes that matter to you. By choosing Texas Public Radio as your designated charity, you help sustain the trusted news, music, cultural programming, and community conversations you value. Contributions may be deducted directly from your paycheck. Contact your human resources representative to learn how to participate. And let TPR know about your workplace gift at tpr.org/workplacegiving.
Welcome back to Fronteras. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. Many conservative communities of color have rules that girls must follow. Those confines prioritize men, are oppressive to women, and have roots in colonialism. Author Prisca Dorcas Mojica Rodriguez grew up in such a culture in Nicaragua. The women in her family lived within the cultural confines and found ways to survive by creating their own judgmental hierarchies. Mojica Rodriguez wrote about these women in the 2024 book Tias and Primas, on knowing and loving the women who raised us. She writes about the archetypes that are pressed on women of color, about the ways she's learned to love and accept the women who pass judgment, and how she embraces those who are judged. The prima perfecta, the cousin who has to bend over backwards to be the perfect kid, your tia la loca, your outcast crazy aunt, the street smart prima who knows how to make things happen, the childless tia who's shamed for either not wanting or not being able to have children. Mojica Rodriguez says she fits every archetype described in her book, and she says the stereotypes and categories she writes about aren't just limited to Latinos.
So I guess I'll answer this in two parts. I've met a lot of Southern Black women who identify with the book. I've met Southeast Asian women who identify with the book. So I'm starting to get to the point where I think it might be a global South story. And I think it has a lot to do with colonialism, our relationship to colonialism, our relationship to Christianity. There's a lot of stuff in there around purity, around the purpose of womanhood, and what, you know, our bodies are supposed to do, and women's purpose. And all of that, I think, is like learned stuff. It's hard to not see the ways that that was taught to us, that was given to us. It was also like the history of colonialism. The indigenous people weren't given the option to opt out without repercussions. So like, for us to be here today, our ancestors at some point had to override what they thought to survive the system that they were being given. So yeah, I think it has to do with colonialism. I think it has to do with the Christianization and everything that came with colonialism.
You know, your upbringing was a little bit stricter than most, I would say. You had a very religious upbringing. And then reading about what you write about, and then learning that you hold a master's in divinity, I'm wondering how you're able to balance that out. How did you try to study it further to sort of understand yourself better? Or I'm curious as to really how that informs how you work, how you write.
Yeah, my dad's a pastor at like a charismatic Latino church, Spanish speaking church. And as a girl in that type of more fundamentalist is what they call it, when it's really like strict to the text, what the text says is truth. There's no like interpretation of the truth. In that denomination, women don't get a voice. I remember when they wanted the women in our church to be able to pray over the tithe. So like, the 10% you're supposed to give at your church to keep the church running, but it's also like the tithe. People will know what that means. So women could pray over the tithing, because you pray over the tithing before or after it starts. They had a huge national convention meeting of all of our churches because women aren't allowed to have any sort of religious authority, and to have them be praying over something that the whole church gave money to was like a huge controversy. So yeah, I come from a really conservative tradition, and I wasn't allowed to question, but I had a lot of questions, because in my church tradition, you're supposed to read the Bible every day. Like, that was expected of us. I've had so many Bibles throughout my life, just developmentally. At one point there were cartoon character Bibles, and then I eventually, you know, aged into like King James, just traditional Bible. But I read my Bible to completion at least 10 times. And when you read the Bible, you start asking questions, because things start to seem a little weird. Like, why did that happen? Why were those women allowed to be sexually assaulted? And it was in the Bible. Where was God? You start having questions, and you start asking them to your parents. And my parents were very big on, like, you're not allowed to question that. And if it sounds confusing, it's because you're lacking in faith. And yeah, when I decided to pursue Bible, it was like, I want to know why. And somebody's going to tell me. I'm going to get answers. You're not giving me answers, but somebody's going to tell me. So I ended up enrolling at Vanderbilt University to get my Master's of Divinity. And little did I know that it would have so much more than just straight Bible. And the way that they treat it is a lot more scientific. Like, we don't have original texts of these texts. A lot of these, especially the Hebrew Bible or Old Testament, as Christians know it, a lot of these texts are based off of older texts of other traditions, like an old Syrian tale or whatever. So it was really interesting to be like, oh, this isn't law. There's different theologies. There's feminist theologies. There's liberation theologies. There's Black theologies. There's Latino theologies. There's Mujerista theologies, which is a specific time of feminist Latina theologies. It felt like the excitement of when I was a kid reading all these books. I was like, oh, it's, I'm learning. I'm loving every second of it. But yeah, it came from a deep curiosity, from being told a lot of no's, and there wasn't enough for me.
And it's funny because those theologies that you're just talking about, those are not the ones that we are taught growing up. And it's the Old Testament-y ones, I think, that are the ones that really come into play when it comes to these women that you write about, and tías and primas. And the one person who you write about in this book that I think stuck with me the most, and I think probably with most readers, is the tía queer, your gay aunt. And this person was shunned for obvious reasons, but also in Nicaragua for a while, it was illegal to be gay. And so this person literally had to live in the shadows. And you write that you had lost touch with her. That story really broke my heart. And I'm wondering if you've been able to reconnect, if maybe the book has helped you find your way back to her.
No, but I've been in no contact with my family for a few years. And I recently went back in contact with my mom, and she was casually telling me a story about being in Nicaragua in April. And she mentioned that she knew she was at her house. And I have so many questions. But as you read in the chapter, my mom doesn't talk positively about this tía. And so I also didn't want to ask her anything because I didn't want it to be tainted by her own judgments. But just the idea that she's back near my grandpa's house made me excited. I wish to go back to Nicaragua as soon as this presidential term is over. I'm a naturalized citizen, and so I wasn't born here, and I don't feel like I have the protections that somebody maybe born here would have, especially as being as outspoken as I am. But as soon as I can, I want to travel back to Nicaragua and find her. That is like in my list of things to do. And I'd love it. Just knowing that she's around, I feel like I can get to her, even just to her kids somehow.
And I don't know if you want to talk more about being no contact with your family, but you do have hints about it in this book that, you know, certain life choices by you have led to that separation. And it's because of those beliefs that are ingrained in our family members and that you write about in Tías y Primas, that has a lot to do with sort of that separation. Do you feel comfortable talking about that at all?
Yeah, it sort of happened as I was writing this book. As I was writing it, I was unearthing a lot of feelings that I had not allowed myself to touch out of probably guilt. I think I'm the oldest daughter in the immigrant household, and I feel this sense of responsibility for my family. And so I didn't allow myself to be angry at my parents. I had just kind of been like, they did what the best they could. You know what everybody tells themselves. They did the best they could, and like, I'm fine, right? Like, I ended up okay. And I had done that for so long. And then I'm writing this book and I'm unearthing things that as I'm writing it that I'm angry about. And I found places where I'm really sad. I found wounds related to my mom that I hadn't dared to touch before. And yeah, it led to us not talking since 2023. Yeah, when I was done writing the book. And I think she felt it kind of happening. I wasn't saying anything to her. I was honestly just trying to process with my therapist because my mom's not really good at being critiqued. I mean, what parent is? But I was just going about it through therapy and trying to figure out how to tend to stuff. But I was also keeping a little more distance because it's hard to deal in therapy with very real feelings and then having to mask it to have this relationship you're maintaining on their terms. So I think in that little bit of distance I was creating just to be able to really investigate what was happening in my body, my mom found my distance uncomfortable. And so she actually initiated the rift. And I just didn't fix it. And the norm in my relationship with my mom is usually, and you read it in the chapter of the dignified tía, she has big feelings and I bring her down and I soothe her and I make her better and I bridge myself to her a lot. Being able to name that was really important and then be able to see it live when she created a rift and me not do an old pattern resulted in almost 3 years of us not talking. And I was shocked how she didn't bend and she didn't call me and she didn't, you know, and I could have done it too. But yeah, like she was the one who got mad at me and exploded and I just didn't fix it as I was expected to.
Well, what I think is always really kind of interesting is, you know, there are certain people within our own families who, when you talk to them, they are, you know, they are the same person no matter what. But I think we find among, you know, maybe immigrant children that they cannot act the same way around different people. You have to adjust who you are and how you respond depending on who it is that you're speaking to. Do you find that you find yourself doing that within members of your own family? It seems like you have to, you know, find ways to walk on eggshells, I guess, when it comes to talking to your mother. I'm wondering if it's the same. You find you have to sort of adjust yourself depending on who it is with whom you're speaking.
100%. There's this really great poem. I wish I could credit the poet, but it said like, I learned you and how to make you happy before I even knew who I was. What would our life had been if we would just be able to be a mother and daughter and not me, the fixer, or something along those lines. And it like hit me because, yeah, I feel like I learned to soothe my mother before I've learned to soothe myself in the last 3 to 4 years. Yeah. And not even great in the way I'm on expert mode with my mom. I know when she's about to get mad, I could tell, I can feel the room shift and something's about to go wrong with her in the way that I can't even do it myself yet. Like until things are bad, then I'm like, oh, I'm not okay. I need to calm down. I need to breathe through whatever I need to do to get soothed. I have to pick it up later than I would even pick it up around my mom. Like, I feel like even the way she laughs, I know something's wrong. I've studied her for years and I acquiesce to her moods constantly. And that's like wounding as a kid. And just to be able to name that feels important to me.
Well, Tías en Primas will be coming out in paperback September 9th, I believe. And what is going to be different about this book? I mean, number one, just the fact that it's in paperback already makes it more accessible to the people who you want to read this book. But I know that usually when there's, you know, another edition coming out, there's going to be maybe a little tweak. Is there something different that people who may have picked up the hardback back in 2024 that they're going to maybe want to pick up this paperback because there's going to be something different, something new?
Yeah. As I was having the conversation around the child-free tía, I loved hearing about other child-free women, and a lot of I wrote childless in that chapter. That's how I worded her. And I had a lot of child-free women reach out and say, I prefer child-free because less means I'm missing something. And so it reinforces that idea versus child-free gives me agency. And I love that switch. And so I switched it throughout the whole book. I was like, yeah, wonderful. I mean, I wrote a lot of the chapter titles around the words that are used against us. So childless is how it would have been used. La que no tiene hijos, you know, like there is a missingness to her, the way that you're talked about in Latina communities. If you don't have a kid and you're a woman who should have had one by now. So I know why I wrote it originally, but I do like how child-free sounds and feels in my body as somebody who's child-free. So yeah, that was a big shift that I had to make and had to fight for in the new manuscript. I think there's a few other ones, but that one was the biggest one, was changing how I refer to this one, Tia.
Well, I'm myself, I'm a child-free Tia.
I love it.
I would love to know, you know, this book came, you know, shortly on the heels of your previous book for Brown Girls. And I'm wondering if you've got anything cooking for, you know, down the road.
Yeah, my young adult novel is out on submission. So hopefully I'll be signing a book deal before the year ends. But I'm switching to fiction. I've always had this like mission to have people have conversations and get people to think. And most avid readers read fiction. So if I want a different kind of reader who's not going to pick up a nonfiction book, I had to make that switch. So I'm writing. It's kind of a combination of Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret by Judy Blume and Anna Green Gables meets An Immigrant Latina. It's supposed to be a 5-book series, but she's the eldest daughter. She's living in this America. So what does it look like to be the eldest daughter dealing with these mass deportations that are happening? You don't get a full childhood when you're an eldest daughter in an immigrant household. It gets truncated by these heavy responsibilities. And as a translator, you're also like hearing and saying things above even your expected vocabulary of like most kids your age. So yeah, it's interesting to write about this girl who's really smart, but it's when you start seeing the beginnings of, oh, that's where the anxiety starts. Oh, that's when you start to feel the weight of responsibility. Oh, this is why you don't trust people when you're in your 30s or whatever. But yeah, I'm having fun writing her, and seeing her in the world will be great.
Well, thank you, Prisca Dorcas Mujica Rodriguez. It's been a huge pleasure to talk to you today. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Prisca Dorcas Mujica Rodriguez is the author of For Brown Girls with Sharp Edges and Tender Hearts, and of Tías and Primas, on Knowing and Loving the Women Who Raised Us. Tías and Primas is out in paperback September 9th. Fronteras editors are Dan Katz and Yvette Benavides. The program is produced by Maria Navarro and Norma Martinez. Chiranga Cakewalk composed our theme music. Hear past episodes at tpr.org and on the Fronteras podcast. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. Thanks for listening.